país que usa hablar. Aquí no se sabe casi nada. Somos un país de Europa, bueno, ustedes saben todas las circunstancias históricas, con muy poca población judía. No se sabe casi nada, la ignorancia es absoluta. Entonces, me hacía gracia porque los autores que tienen sentido del humor hay en algún momento que ironizan con esta cliché de pueblo del libro. El pueblo del libro que dice esto que potencian los políticos y los festivales y tal. Digo, bueno, para ellos es un lugar común, pero para gente que no sabe casi nada, milagrosamente sí que saben que es el pueblo del libro, con lo cual algo hemos avanzado, algo se sabe, se relaciona los judíos, aunque sean de una forma intuitiva, de memoria ancestral, pues con textos, con, bueno, yo como digo, mejor un lugar común que no nada, que la nada más absoluta. Entonces, para el lector de español, insisto que es muy fascinante porque se puede resumir de una forma nada autoritaria, de una forma muy agradable para la lectura, todo lo que ha sido esto, cómo se enseñaba, cómo se transmitían las lecturas en las familias, cómo se sentaban, cómo los niños tenían su papel desde muy pequeños. Pero hay una cosa que me ha gustado mucho, que es el sentido interclasista, que hay un capítulo que leo la cita, dice: ningún colectivo premoderno fue sistemáticamente expuesto en sus hogares a textos escritos a través de un ancho espectro social. Aquí hacen la diferencia de la Europa medieval, que imperaba en las clases pobres el analfabetismo más total, y hacen la diferencia, que eso me parece muy importante para un lector europeo que no esté muy iniciado en la cultura judía. Esto llama la atención de entrada, el aspecto interclasista. En los hogares judíos, padres y madres, abuelos y abuelas rezaban y bendecían y narraban, recitaban y cantaban. Recorrían un notablemente amplio corpus de textos, una y otra vez. Este apartado, dicen los autores, este apartado de historia social es para nosotros el hecho de mayor importancia relacionado con la supervivencia de los judíos. Bueno, como en la anterior ocasión, querría que nos ampliara un poco esta idea tan bonita, interclasista, que realmente es un particularismo judío, porque las clases sociales han imperado en todas las culturas.
Mercedes, if I comment on all the wonderful things you said, then I have no tapas and wine tonight. There will be no time. So first, let me welcome the ambassador and the cultural attaché of Israel. Shalom, Mr. Ambassador, this cultural attaché. Welcome. And let me begin by a further irony that Mercedes did not mention, of the expression "the people of the book." All our politicians in Israel and everybody who opens a book festival is talking about us, the Jews, the people of the book. Nobody mentions the fact, or very seldom do they mention the fact, that this title of the people of the book was given to us by the Muslims in the Quran. The Quran lists the people of the book, and the Jews are one of them. And this is one of the beautiful ironies of interculturality. But we have to be aware of interculturality. No culture sits alone. Jewish culture over the millennia was never a virgin. It was always affected by other cultures, and it always gave to other cultures, even when not all the rabbis were happy to admit it. So the Jewish culture had affairs, love affairs, hate love affairs, illicit affairs, with everyone, from the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Persians and the Aramaic, to the Greeks and the Romans and the Arabs, of course, and medieval Europe, Catholic Europe, modern Europe, beyond Europe. All these cultures affected us, and we affected them in turn. When I travel the world today, I can meet a Rebecca in Hong Kong, and an Aboriginal gentleman in the Australian desert whose name is Isaac. The Bible is all over the world, but we too have received so much from other cultures, not least from Sfarad. History is tragic, your history, our history, the joint meeting points of our histories have been tragic. But one of my Jewish experiences that run in my blood is that beyond the tragedy and beyond the tears, we should be able to smile, even to laugh at ourselves, and to hope for a future. And these two Jewish elements of smiling through the tears and hoping through the future has been permanent ever since Abraham and Sarah, the first laugher in the Bible. And you know what? The point of having books on the family table was a Jewish uniqueness. And the fact that I believe in intercultural dialogue and in the effect of cultures on each other does not mean that I cannot be proud of the uniqueness of my own culture. Not triumphalist, not nationalist, but proud in what was truly unique. And what was truly unique is that until early modern times, the only family tables in the world that had books on them were the Jewish family tables. Because in every other book culture, the books were with the strong men in their own bastions, the Mandarin in China, the wise men of Egypt, Socrates and Plato in Athens, the Roman Senate, the Catholic Church, the bastions of the strong men. But the Jews, who were not strong and who had no bastions during their years of diaspora, kept their books and their clever boys around the family table, so that not only the clever boys, but also the clever girls were able to learn to read.
Pues ya que la última palabra era clever girls, las chicas voy a retomar. Hay un capítulo muy interesante, porque para mí era bastante desconocido, que los autores exponen los personajes femeninos de la Biblia. Yo tengo que decir que son unos conocedores fantásticos de la Biblia. Esto es muy curioso porque, en Israel se ha mantenido la lectura de la Biblia. En España no hay una cultura católica de leer la Biblia en las familias. Yo me acuerdo que una vez mi madre me dijo, dice, no, es que esto es cosa de los protestantes. En las familias católicas no estaba presente la Biblia. Esto se consideraba que era un cura que lo interpretaba y tal. Bueno, estas cosas sorprendentes cuando la Biblia, como muy bien describen los autores, es un texto más allá de todo, el hipertexto, más allá de todos los textos. Hay una cita muy bonita. La Biblia para nosotros es un peliagudo cóctel de hechos, de mitos y de esa clase de ficción que puede transmitir profundas verdades. Esto es más o menos un leitmotiv que se repite todo el rato. Pero hay esto en el capítulo de las mujeres, una cosa que me ha parecido muy interesante. Una organización, también volvemos a lo de la Edad Media, analfabeta, triste, cristiana, esta continuidad judía de los textos, ¿no? En las mujeres, dicen los autores, si se comparan muchas mujeres, madres en la Biblia y en general en la historia judía, empeñadas no solo en nutrir, sino en narrar y volver a narrar la vieja historia. Es como un imperativo ancestral que justifica la supervivencia biológica. Al lado de esto, dicen los autores, y esto me ha parecido interesante, muchas de las grandes protagonistas de la mitología y el teatro griego, muchas diosas, muchas heroínas trágicas, son con frecuencia asesinas. ¿Es verdad? Su tragedia se culmina con su muerte sin descendencia, perdiendo a sus hijos o incluso matándolos. Antígona, Medea, etcétera, eligieron la muerte. Por el contrario, los personajes israelitas y judíos Esto me parece muy interesante porque hay una insistencia en esto de apostar por la vida. Por el contrario, los personajes israelitas y judíos a lo largo de las épocas, y hay una cita en Deuteronomio, te puse delante la vida y la muerte, la bendición y la maldición, escoge la vida para que viváis tú y tu simiente. Bueno, pues en todas las épocas estos personajes judíos casi siempre, dicen los autores, eligen la vida. Y dicen y añaden, por tanto, si la continuidad, la sucesión judía consiste en vivir para narrar la narración, la vida de un niño es entonces importante, importantísima. No solo y obviamente por su propia salvación, sino también porque el niño es el precioso siguiente capítulo del libro. Hay realmente muchas citas preciosas para seguir trayendo a esta conversación, pero quería comparar esto. Estas culturas que se basan en la muerte, bueno, yo me acuerdo que, no sé, pequeños niños católicos, había muchos que vivíamos aterrorizados porque las imágenes eran tremendas, eran de unas hachas atravesando la cabeza de algún mártir. Era una cultura bastante que insistía bastante en la muerte. Y me ha parecido muy, muy interesante, muy bonito esta insistencia en escoger la vida. Y bueno, era otra vez que ampliara esta apuesta por la vida, que es parte de la continuidad judía. Yes.
You know, I must say this, last month I was in Athens and Thessaloniki when the book came out in Greek to a wonderful audience. And my Greek friends laughed at me because, like, we write in the book that the ancient Greek women of the mythology and history and, of course, tragedy end up not having children at all, or killing them, or losing them, or eating them. And the Israelite children are all mothers, and those who are not mothers are struggling to become mothers and then to keep their children alive, to tell them the story, to carry on the story. So my Greek friends said, but you know, Fania, that our mythology was like that, but in real life we are sure that mothers in ancient Athens were very good mothers, I think. I'm also very sure. But the stories a culture tells something about the culture. And here in this book we have all sorts of interesting political fights. You have to know Israeli reality a little bit, but some of them are universal political arguments. We argue against the extremist rabbis, but we also argue against the extreme post-Zionism and the new school of archaeology that says that the Jews are not a nation, they are a modern invention, they are not connected to the biblical past. And some of the archaeologists are telling us, you know, we are digging and digging and we can't find the big palaces of David and Solomon. Where are they? So it was all fiction. So on the other one hand, the ultra-religious tell us it's all truth, you have to believe it all. And the neo-archaeologists and neo-post-Zionists are saying, it's all fiction, don't believe anything. And we make the following response, and this is interesting because we are a team of a novelist and a historian, so we have different notions of truth. But we have put our conversations, our voice together, and we respond to both sides in the following way. We say, first of all, suppose that much of the Bible is fiction. Okay. But you don't frighten a novelist with fiction. Because a novelist knows that a good story can convey a very deep, as you said, a very deep truth. And if a society tells its own stories through a strong sense of justice, a strong sense of equality, equal distribution of food so that nobody will be hungry, strong women who rise and change history and make their voice heard. Suppose it was all invented, but this was the ideal of that culture. This was the ideal. This is what they hoped they will become. And in this sense, it is truth, and a very deep human truth. And to the archaeologists who are digging and not finding the palace of David, we are saying, we don't need the palace of David, because the words are our palaces. The books of the Bible are our cathedrals, our Chinese wall, our pyramid. And they stand undemolished in the flow of time. And they are still here, and what's more, unlike the Chinese wall, the pyramids, and the Parthenon, they're not only in one place, they belong to the whole world now, and we can share them with the whole world.
He oído, porque claro, aquí lo leemos con, digamos, la inocencia del lector que no está metido en una cultura, en una vida diaria de un país, en este caso Israel, y no sabemos qué tipo de polémica ni controversia. Yo de una forma inocente lo dije que para mí era una lectura cultural, era una lectura social y cultural, era como leer un libro de microhistoria, de estos historiadores, desde Carlo Ginzburg y todos ellos que se han dedicado a contar la historia de las familias de una forma muy cercana, y los que nos gusta la literatura, claro, nos gusta mucho la microhistoria, y al mismo tiempo un relato lingüístico literario. Hay una historia muy, muy apasionante de cómo nace el hebreo. Para las personas que no lo saben, es muy bonito. El hebreo, que no es que nazca de la nada, sino que, o sea, a ver si me corrige la autora, no es una lengua muerta, sino que es una lengua durmiente. Durmiente, la practicaban, me imagino, una minoría, y bueno, y se pone, y esto es un milagro fantástico, que en la historia no se produce, eso es increíble. Bueno, pues todo esto se relata también en el libro, las lenguas de la diáspora. Aquí hay una buenísima traductora del yiddish, bueno, que ha sido la traductora también del inglés de aquí, Rodavia Cassis, y que nos conocimos en el año del centenario de Vashevi Singer. Hace 10 años ya, ay, Dios mío. Entonces, bueno, y el ladino. Y luego, pues las otras múltiples. En algún momento se dice el inglés, pero bueno, yo tendría que decir que, claro, yo la historia de los judíos la he leído. Mi ignorancia o no ignorancia viene de Giorgio Bassani, de los cuentos de Odessa, de Isaac Babel, de Joseph Roth, de las historias de la familia de Primo Levi. La gente se cree que Primo Levi es solo los Campos. No, tiene historias preciosas que les recomiendo siempre a todo el mundo, de historias de sus tíos y sus tías muy divertidas, con mucho sentido del humor. En fin, hay una gran cantidad de lenguas de la diáspora que nos han educado.
By the way, Mercedes Bashevis Singer,
¿sí?
It was from his mother.
Ah, yes.
He took his inspiration.
Yes.
Not from his the reader of the Talmud, but his mother read everything. Dostoevsky.
Proust.
Yes, and also the mother of Proust. It all came from the mothers in a very interesting way. Forgive me for interrupting.
No. Es fundamental. Las madres somos fundamentales. en la transmisión oral, es verdad, pues se habla mucho, y los padres también, no quiero aquí decir una, pero parece que inmediatamente los he nombrado como hombre objeto. No, o sea, ellos participan muy vivamente en la educación, pero bueno, sí, en la transmisión oral de las historias, y lo contáis todo el rato, que en la narración, esta narración ininterrumpida, las mujeres, pues en todas las épocas, hijas de rabinos, no hijas de rabinos, mujeres más sencillas, la madre de Proust, que era de la alta sociedad, la madre de Vashevi Singer, bueno, hay una gran cantidad de historias, por esto que es muy apasionante, porque son microhistorias de muchas personajes, mujeres que eran la mujer del rabino. Bueno, creo que esto era la madre de Vashevi Singer. Bueno, aquí los especialistas en Vashevi Singer me corregirán, que cuando el marido, el rabino judicial, ¿no? Ella ocupaba también el lugar y también aconsejaba de los divorcios y de los matrimonios y tal. Bueno, es muy interesante todo esto, porque realmente es una concatenación de historias, como muñecas rusas, de que una muñeca rusa va saliendo de otra muñeca rusa. Entonces, bueno, en todo esto vuelvo al tema de que yo, lectora española, o muchos de nosotros lectores españoles, se nos escapa la realidad del país, ¿no? De la lectura que hacemos quizás es más naif en algunos momentos, porque es literal sin ninguna connotación. Y he oído en algún sitio que ha sido un poquito motivo de debate político. No, aquí no me puedo imaginar por qué el debate político en una obra así. ¿En qué zona del libro hay el problema?
Well, in Israel, everything's fast a political debate. If you sneeze in Israel, you will get a political debate around it. And I have to say that although Israel, as we all know, is a politically very ardent and often very aggressive country, I would say that 95% of our conflicts, not just between Jews and Arabs, also between Jews and Jews, are mediated through words, sometimes very strong words, rather than through violence. And we like it this way. We like being verbally combatant rather than truly combatant. I hope that the last 5% will also be translated into words rather than violence. And we are all great talkers. The political debates of this book, as I've hinted before, are both against the interpretation of the ultra-Orthodox Jews and their leaderships, who believe that they hold the only true Judaism. Not knowing, you know, we don't like this word so much, because the word Judaism was really invented by academics in the 19th century. Before that, if you ask people, Jewish people around the world, what are you? They would say, what are you collectively? They would say, we are Israel. Israel, the name of one man. And we are a nation of individuals who like to be called by their names, and the nation too is called by the name of one ancient father. Judaism is something very cold, but now it is also used in Israel as an aggressive word by the ultra-believers against secular like myself. And they are saying, you are not really Jewish. Part of the purpose of this book is not to argue that we are more Jewish or no less Jewish than they are, but to show them that we are differently Jewish, and that we hold our interpretation to be no less valid than theirs, and that our marriage with Western ideals, with liberalism, with humanism, with notions of social justice, is, forgive me for saying so, a Catholic marriage. We are not going to give up on our Western affiliation the way they wish it to be. We are not going to live in an atavistic, halachaic, ancient Jewish state the way they wish it to be. And one of the strong reasons for this being that this Western tradition of liberalism, humanism, and the quest for justice, social justice, has strong Jewish chromosomes itself. It also belongs to us. It was fed by the Bible as a great textbook of politics and law. This is something to remember. This is one argument. We also have an argument with a nationalist right in Israel, who wish to claim the whole land, the whole historical land of Israel, to the Jewish nation only, and we are saying no such thing. Because for us, our nationhood is not aggressive, is not ultra-territorialist. Our nation is textual. And the texts, the shimmering biblical Israel of the texts, is something that you can recarve for the future, and you can also share it between two nations. There is enough for the two of us. And the texts, the Jewish texts, they now belong to the whole world. And on the other hand, we have a political debate with the extreme left, as I've also hinted before, with people who are saying to us today, the Jewish nation is a new invention of the Zionists here to claim a nation land, and we have no connection to the ancient Israelites, it's only a religion. And we are saying, that is my co-author and I are suggesting, it cannot be only a religion. Because in my family, in the Oz family, Salzberger family, Klausner, going all the way back 5 generations already, we are secular. My ancestors have lost their belief in God 5 generations ago, and you know what? My 2 children are still very, very Jewish. Still very Jewish. In what counts? They know the Bible, they know how to argue, they know how to answer back to their parents and teachers, and they are out looking for social justice right now as we speak. And so I strongly believe that in terms of textual nationhood, we are linked. We invented a new English word, texted,
sí,
to our ancestors.
Textualizado. Pueblo
we are textualizado, beautiful. We are textualizado to Abraham and Sarah, and I don't care if I don't have any genes in me from Abraham and Sarah. I don't care if my genes are Spanish or German or Cossack or you name it. This doesn't matter to me because our line is not a biological line. It is not a bloodline, it is a text line. And in this respect, we feel our belonging to the land of Israel very, very strongly. We simply don't need all of it. We are happy to share it the way we are happy to share our books with the rest of the world.
Muchas gracias, Fania. Bueno, yo les quiero pasar la palabra porque veo al público numeroso y muy interesado y voy a hacer honor a la parte de los autores ausente y para acabar nada, dos líneas del padre de Fania, de Amos-Oz, en 1982. Amos-Oz visitó el asentamiento de Ofra en la ribera occidental del Jordán y mantuvo un acalorado, dicen en el libro, acalorado debate con los pobladores. Yo cuando oigo a Fania, cuando oigo este apasionamiento de los debates de Israel, parecéis latinos. Yo creo que por eso los españoles estamos también en Israel cuando vamos, porque hay como algo familiar, ¿no? En esta cosa de engancharnos con las palabras. Bueno, y dice Amos-Oz: el judaísmo es una civilización y una de las pocas civilizaciones que han dejado su huella en toda la humanidad. La religión es un elemento central de la civilización judía, tal vez incluso su origen, pero esa civilización no puede ser presentada como nada más que una religión. Bueno, acabo con estas palabras de Amos-Oz y les paso la palabra a alguno de ustedes que quiera preguntar algo.
Buenas tardes, muchas gracias. Thank you very much. I want to ask you about two distinctions that appear in the book that compare Jews with others. One is the ideology related to life and martyrdom, and the other, more focused on Christianity and Judaism, the ideology of the simple and maybe ignorant on the one hand, and the more sophisticated, intelligent people on the other. And so this is two distinctions that I found new for me and very interesting, and would you want to say a little some things about that?
Yes, I have thank you for these questions. I have a long-standing love affair with Christianity. And indeed Catholic Christianity. I didn't tell you that, Ambassador, but during my years in Oxford, I studied Aquinas with a Dominican priest in the Dominican friary in Oxford. And that meant drinking a lot of wine, because he loved red wine. So for me, Aquinas will always have the taste of excellent red wine, which is a very Jewish thing, by the way, to put together learning and something very tasty on the table. It works very well, as the book suggests. Now, in regard to Martin Donnes, this is a big difference, because while Christianity, as I understand it, in a way looked at the martyrs, at the saints, with elation, Jews were martyred in their own history against their will. So there was no adoration of martyrs, because the people did not want to become martyrs. The people did not want their children to become martyrs. The child is the new chapter of the book, as you have read from our book, and you do not want to martyr your children. In this sense, if I may allow myself a sad moment, think about the agony of the Maranos, of those mothers and fathers who chose the life of their children over the faith, over the right to continue to tell the story to the children. This is a terrible, terrible choice, because the whole idea is that the children will carry your story to the future. And this is why I believe that the Marano mothers, the Jewish mothers converted, at night before bed, still whispered a few Hebrew words in the ears of their children. And I think some of those Hebrew words have reached Sfarad, Spain today, and are still alive underneath today. So this was just an aside about the tragedy of being martyred in the sense of not being able to continue your story and your family. Perhaps the worst moment in Jewish history. So no, we do not believe in martyrdom. And on this, I think that we are different both from traditional Christianity and from Islam, including some parts of Islam today. The second very interesting point, I also thought a lot about it, is really the Christian ideal of innocentia, of sancta simplicitas. I don't know what's the Spanish way to translate, pronounce it, but sancta simplicitas. So the untaught children, let the children come to me, he says, because they are still pure, because they have not learned. This is the point in which Jesus Christ departs from Judaism. He was a Jew. He was a very profound Jew. But when he uttered the sentence about the little children, at least the way we understand it today, maybe we are getting it wrong, he departed from Judaism because Jewish tradition does not believe in unlearned children, does not believe in little angels who are pure and haven't learned. When you have a baby, and this baby is weaned from milk and can start talking at the age of 3, this is the time to start teaching him. And in many cases, to start teaching her. Because we do not want innocent, untaught children. And the best music in our ears are the voices of little children repeating and learning the alphabet. There is no sweeter music than that. But once they learn the alphabet and started reading, they are like Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden. They are no longer innocent. They are no longer simple and saintly. They are human beings like all of us, but hopefully they will be readers all their lives.
¿Alguien más quiere hacer alguna pregunta? La traductora del libro.
All questions answered. There is no such thing in Jewish tradition that all questions have been answered, because there are always new ones.
Bueno, seguiré yo. Yo era para dar un poco de juego, ¿no? Ahora que estamos en los mundiales y nos ha salido tan mal lo de dar el juego.
Let me maybe enter the silence by telling you a story which has some very big questions, and these big questions may cause you to think of a few questions too. You know, we end our book with the story of the grandmother. Mm-hmm. So maybe some of you have not yet read the book, or not to the end, and they will still not know the story of the grandmother, which I think for me raises a whole lot of questions. And it's a joke. And it's worse than a joke. It's an American Jewish joke. But it's still... But it's still... I think it conveys something very deep and something we wanted to say in our book. And the joke is that this American Jewish grandmother walks on the beach with her little grandson, and suddenly comes a big wave and snatches the baby from her arms, and it disappears in the water. And grandmother looks up and starts asking questions. God Almighty, what have I done to you? What have I done to deserve this? Wasn't I a good Jew all my life? Didn't I follow all the commandments? How are you doing this to me? Note that everything is in the form of a question. Before she finishes asking her big questions, another big wave comes and brings the child back into her arms, safe and sound. Grandmother looks up to the sky and says, God Almighty, thank you very much, but he was also wearing a hat. I know, it could have been a Spanish grandmother too. But note how many elements come together in this little joke. Because remember, jokes are important too. Don't you believe it that Judaism is only the heaviest text of the Talmud? There are also the lightest, most glittering anecdotes, jokes, songs, proverbs. They are as wise as the deep Talmud. I don't believe in high and low culture, as you can see. I think it is blended together. This grandmother of ours is deeply and assertively practicing what we call in our book the theology of chutzpah. What we call in our book irreverent reverence. She believes in, of course she believes in God, but she is also able to argue against him, to reproach him, to scold him, to bring him to justice. Now, if you show this joke to a rabbi, the rabbi will say to you, oh, God was only testing grandmother. But we are saying, uh-uh, not so. Grandmother was testing God. And God didn't want to be tested, because you don't want to know what will happen if grandmother has to decide between her faith and her grandchild. Because you see, and this is the deep theology, without God, the believers think there would be no grandchildren. But we say, without grandchildren, there will be no God. This is the secular take on the matter. If you do not come up with questions, I will have to give you some more Jewish jokes. I'm warning you.
Bueno, yo querría que Fania, esto hago trampa porque es una anécdota que contó, yo estaba presente y quiero que la repita, que viajó en un avión con un rabino y me gustaría que explicara la historia del viaje en avión con un rabino y cómo se produjo todo esto en el tiempo. Una historia que contó.
Ah, ok. This is new, this is a story from last month. So last month I was boarding a plane. You see, this book makes me travel a lot. And I like this because there is something global about the conversation we are having. It's not only an inner Jewish conversation. It's a conversation between cultures today. So I was in a very cultural place called Luton Airport, England. And I was boarding a plane, an Al plane back to Israel, sitting on my seat. All the seats are being full, and in comes a very big and prominent rabbi, and you could see he was a very important ultra-Orthodox rabbi, big black hat with fur, big white beard, looking very holy, and poor man, he has to sit next to me. So he refused, you know, these days they refuse to sit next to a woman, try to negotiate with the stewards, no way, he has to sit next to me. So he sat next to me, and after takeoff, I raised my glass of water, I say, Rabbi, I know you didn't want to sit next to me, but I still wish you a good flight. He opened his mouth and didn't close it till we landed in Tel Aviv Airport. I'm telling you, it was the best flight in his life. You could see. We had, of course, a long, interesting conversation. I found out what I already knew, that he's a big rabbi from Bnei Brak, one of the most ultra-Orthodox bastions in Israel. He knows the Talmud much better than I do, no question about it. But I also found out that I, the little girl from the kibbutz school, know the Bible much better than he does, because they don't really learn the Bible. So he didn't really know how many strong women there are in the Bible. And he didn't really know that when he tells the women of his community that they should cover themselves up and stay home and not talk in public and not sing in public, you know, that's what they say these days. It's not the way the biblical women behaved. And he did not even know that the respected Maimonides, who is displayed so beautifully in the exhibition here in the Casa del Lector, in the exhibition of the Hebrew National Library, there's a wonderful, wonderful panel on Maimonides, and I admire many things about Maimonides, but on this, excuse me, Mr. Maimonides, I have a little correction. You see, Maimonides took with a pincet one little verse from the book of Psalms and interpreted it to mean the opposite of what it says in context. Because in context, a beautiful princess comes to Jerusalem displaying all her finery in front of the palace, and the paparazzi, which is the biblical author, is giving us a description of everything she's wearing. He loves it. It's like a Tel Aviv scene with a supermodel coming out. And there was a sentence saying, all her luggage is brought in to the palace. All her luggage is brought in. Luggage in Hebrew, kvuda. Kol kvuda bat melech pnim. Honor in Hebrew, kvoda. What did Maimonides do? He took the word luggage, kvuda, made a tiny little change of hyphenation and pronouncement, and said, all the honor of a woman is indoors. You women should stay indoors until the 21st century. So we, Amos and Fania, with our biblical education, can tell the rabbi from Bnei Brak that Maimonides was wrong, that this is not what the Bible says. That actually no woman in the Bible stays at home. They are all outdoors all the time. They are singing loudly, they are dancing loudly, they are giving speeches, they are leading the nation sometimes, and they are changing history in several crucial moments. So we talk, the rabbi and I, and then we land in Ben Gurion Airport and we say goodbye. Of course, I do not offer my hand to shake, but you would not touch a woman's hand. So I was very demure. I go back home to Zichron Yaakov, and I send him our book, Yehudim Umilim, in Hebrew, with a dedication. I knew the name of his yeshiva in Bnei Brak, so I sent him to the yeshiva in Bnei Brak, and I thought I would never hear from him again. 3 weeks later, I get an email. This is like getting an email from Maimonides himself. Not from the rabbi. No, the rabbi doesn't do this. M. Nathanson's secretary, of course it's a male secretary, not a female secretary. Dear Mrs. Oz, thank you very much for sending the book to the rabbi. The rabbi has no time to read it at all. He's too busy learning the Torah. And he also thinks that your book, with all due respect, does not agree with his own view of Judaism. Thank you very much. M. Nathanson's secretary. So I showed this email to my father, and my father says, Fania, do you think that he is not reading the book? He is reading the book, and what's even more important, his wife is reading the book.
Bueno, habrán visto lo buenísima narradora que es Fania y lo divertida. Si ninguno de ustedes quiere intervenir, hay una pregunta clásica que en la que acaban muchas conversaciones, bueno, si ustedes deciden no continuar, preguntando qué es acerca de Internet. ¿Cómo influye Internet en toda esta transmisión? De todas las culturas en general. Hay dos versiones para Internet. La optimista, Internet es para bien, para todo lo bueno que se puede sacar de la vida actual, y hay la versión pesimista. Ojo con Internet porque las generaciones jóvenes se están soltando de los libros, y ahí el peligro de Internet, como todos sabemos, es que si uno llega con una cultura ya sólida, asentada, es muy útil, pero si no, es peligroso. Como le llama, que es de mis frases favoritas, Humberto Eco le llama alfabetización distraída. Que me encanta la definición de Internet. Entonces, hay en algún momento del libro, que esto me produjo bastante curiosidad, que ellos, los autores, que son optimistas, yo también me declaro optimista, porque yo creo que el optimismo forma parte del progreso, de creer que las cosas van para bien, creemos en el progreso, y mucha gente pesimista, catastrófica, es la reacción, los reaccionarios, igual lo estoy simplificando, pero bueno. Ellos, los autores, dicen que Internet, para los fanáticos, para los intolerantes, se les va a acabar a la larga, porque Internet es también la conversación, el debate, y ahí ya se les ha fastidiado el negocio. Bueno, quería que me ampliaran un poco su versión.
With pleasure. You know, Ellie and I have 2 teenage boys. When they were 14, they started coming to me and asking me about Leonardo da Vinci, about Michelangelo, about Machiavelli. I was so delighted. It turned out that they are playing a computer game called The World of Warfare, in which you... Not Ninja, no, it's The World of Warfare, in which you need the advice of Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Machiavelli in order to kill Cesare Borgia. So I said, okay, at least they are learning history from the computer game. My father is not so optimistic, and people often ask us about writing the book together, what did you argue about? Because not all the arguments come into the book, but we certainly argued about the internet, about computers, about electronic books, Kindle. My father says, this is the invention of Satan. This is the end of the book. I don't believe in a text that I cannot touch, smell. I tell him, Papa, touch my iPad. You know, as I said before, it's a tablet, touch it. He said, no, it's not the same thing. This is from Satan. This will be the end of civilization as we know it. But for me, the answer is different. Not only because I love the internet and use it for my research all the time, and much of the work on the book was using wonderful websites that we now had, including the one of the Israel National Library in Jerusalem, and many, many other beautiful sites that we can use today to do research, in ways that before you had to travel around the world to the Bodleian Library, to other European libraries, to the Pergamon Museum. Nowadays it's all online, beautifully online. Also, I believe that books will have to find their way into the digital world and tempt our children again. And I can see that happening when I look around. It may take a little bit time, but I do not believe that the book will die. I do not believe that the internet or reality shows on television will kill good literature. Because nothing can kill good literature. It might take different forms. So what is the way for the future, people ask me? How shall we make our children and grandchildren love books again? How shall we put books on the family table, on the dinner table, like the old Jewish tradition? Because this is today a universal suggestion that our book is making. And I think part of the answer is the Casa del Lector, and every place like it around the world. Part of the answer is the friendly, open, democratic, half-digital, half-bookish space which people and young people can visit and love. Part of the future is the way of tempting them back to reading, back to grandmother, back to grandfather, and their own new creativity through the combination of the book and the digital media. I think we shall live to see generations of reading children. They will not be innocent. They will be readers, and not only Jewish children. Thank God for that. We have a question. Ah, wonderful.
But I want to tell you something, nothing to do with the book, but something that I mentioned to Leo. The first time I ever been to a visa was here in Spain about 10 years ago, it was very simple, and it was something experience I never experienced before. And the way it goes, for me, when I compare it to us in the synagogue, the way people say the poor say something and people repeat. The poor say something and people repeat. And with us, you know, we all have books, in America, in the book. We all have the sidur, we pray, and sometimes the candles and one sentence just for us to know where he is. You know, and it was the first time it occurred to me that if we yet all over the years get to know to be, mm-hmm. So if not, we would wait. And they couldn't belong to the Jewish people.
No, there is
fundamentally the Arab people.
There is a big difference between the way Christians, Muslims, and Jews pursue their faith. And I'm not an expert in faith, but I can tell you because absolutely, I can suggest to you, as we suggest in the book, why we think that the Jews will never have a pope. And not in 3,000 years of Jewish history do we have one rabbi who was agreed on everybody, upon everyone, and everybody trusted. You always had at least two rabbis fighting one another. Why can't the Jews have a pope? And the answer is, and this is my father's answer, that suppose the Jews elected a pope tomorrow, so 10 Jewish cardinals would meet in Jerusalem and elect a Jewish pope. The next day when he goes out, somebody will come over him to the pope, slap the pope on his or her shoulder, and say, "Hey pope, you don't know me, but I know you, because my mother and your father were cousins in Casablanca, or in Minsk, or in Plotsk, and now that we know that our family know one another, let me tell you, Mr. Pope, what I really think about how to believe in God." Now, this is the Jewish way. You cannot have one person telling everyone else what to think or how to think. Mm-hmm. Yes. But of course, you know, speaking of multiculturality, when I grew up in my humble kibbutz home, where we had a record player, my parents, you know, it was a room the size of this table, more or less. We had a record player, and we only had 10 records. But one of the 10 records was the Missa Creola that my mother loved, and I heard it so many times because we only had 10 records that I know it by heart. And this way I found out that I, without knowing it, I know the Christian Mass by heart as well. Very helpful for my future life, and I'm very thankful for it. Any other arguments, protests, perhaps disagreements? Yes. One piece of advice to my audience: never write a book with your father or with your mother before you are 50 years old. After that, it's okay. It was not our idea. It came from Yale University Press and the Posen Foundation doing a big project on Judaism as civilization and culture. My father said, "No, I cannot write a book by invitation." But then he said, "Wait a minute. Since Fanny and I have been talking about it for the last 40 years, maybe we should sit down and see what happens." It was the nicest experience for both of us. And you know, writers always tell you how difficult, hard, sad, lonely it is to write a book. In our case, it was a very happy experience. Exchanging our oral conversations, what we are doing now, you know, the Jewish way, from oral to written, from written to oral. And we changed our oral conversation into writing. It was a wonderful experience. We argued a lot. He refused to use my laptop. He refused to use my iPad. He said, "Keep it away from me." But other than that, it went in a very interesting way. And until today, when we meet, we keep conversing, writing, and rewriting this book. So who knows? But maybe the next book we write together would be a literary murder mystery. This is our idea for the future. Yes, I think we had another question.
Another question?
Yes, the translator has asked if you can please use the microphone for the sake of the translator, of our interpreter.
No tengo palabras en español, por eso quería hacer.
les hables del idioma de la, del humor de la cosa judía y me ha hecho otra vez revivir cada momento en mi vida. Soy abuela, pero me ha hecho revivir cada momento en mi vida. He venido aquí con amigos, con mis amigos aquí para ver, para encontrarte y para decir gracias a ti. Muchísimas gracias por conocer todos los amigos, decimos cada momento.
So Daraba, you are very kind, and now I will sum up with very, very brief capsule of Jewish wisdom. If I needed to put the whole of Jewish wisdom in one word, I would say read. If I had to put the whole of Jewish wisdom in four words, I would say read with your children. But if I had to put the whole of Jewish wisdom into 10 words, and this is the last one, into 10 words, I would say, read with your children, with good food on the table. This is our advice in...